Podcast. I'm your host, David Boyles. Since 2007, Arconyx provided animation and visual effects services to the TV and film industries. Recently, Arconyx made the transition to indie game development to pursue projects with philanthropic goals. When we started planning the goal to create, when they started planning their goal to create a game earlier in the year, they came across many wonderful organizations, such as Game Changer Charity, that use games to help kids cope with the trauma and hardship that stems from having life-threatening illnesses. And we'll discuss that quite a bit in the podcast today, too. They are entirely focused on bringing uplifting game experiences to those who need it most. Kenny, I want to say thank you for joining us today.
No, thank you. My pleasure.
So, you have a fantastic story, great game, obviously won some awards at GDC. We had an opportunity to meet at GDC earlier this year, specifically at the Microsoft booth. And I loved what you and your team have put together. So would you mind giving us a quick overview as to what your title is? And then we'll start with, I guess, how you got started in the gaming industry or any kind of art and technical background as a whole.
Absolutely. Yeah, there's a lot to talk about. So the game we're currently working on, let's start with the present. So we're working on a game called I Hope, and it is a 3D adventure game sort of in the vein of like Zelda Breath of the Wild. And in this game, you play as a girl named Hope, and you battle a metaphorical monster that mirrors the real life struggle of a battle with cancer. And in the game, you go through multiple levels, and you gain the weapons you need to defeat this enemy. And those weapons are knowledge, okay, strength, courage, support, and most importantly, hope. And so by making this game, what the goal is to give children who are actually struggling with this disease and their families a little bit of the coping mechanisms that they would need to emotionally handle this battle that they're going through. And so far, the feedback has been just overwhelming. There has been some kids who have played it who have really responded very positively in terms of like just even on one level how the game itself feels and plays. They say that it plays great and that it looks beautiful, but also how the emotional support that they feel like they're getting from the game. I've had parents say that when they watch their kids play it, that child who's had a rare form of cancer for 7 years really, really, really does not like to talk about the disease, doesn't like to talk about his treatment. I received an email about an hour after I met with his family and had him play it that this mother had, you know, seen this child actually start to open up and was excited about the game. And that really, really touched me very, very, very deeply, because if I can just maybe just start the process of a kid being able to feel like he can even like say the word cancer and start to face this thing and give him the emotional support, him or her, the emotional support that they need to start that process, that's fantastic. That's already 1,000 times bigger, you know, an accomplishment than I could have dreamed to set for this game. But it's really fantastic to feel that happening already. The game's not even done yet, and this is just like the demo that these kids are playing, and they're already getting excited about it. So it started essentially. So game dev all started for me kind of the way that a lot of indie developers start, whereas, you know, just tinkering around with free game engines and, making fun little stuff. I offered game development as one of the services that we provide, and we got hired by IBM to do this little game. So things were going pretty well, and game dev, I definitely knew that it was going to be a thing that I wanted to do a lot more of in the future. But around the beginning of 2016, I was searching for what the project was going to be that was really going to be the breakout sort of like, you know, stamp the Arconics name on something and really try to show people this is what we're about. And I knew it had to be philanthropic, and I knew it had to have a message that was really needed by some folks. And so when I was thinking about what that could be, it was basically like, you know, what more powerful a message is there than hope when hope right. is lost? And who needs that more than, you know, children fighting for their lives in hospitals right now? So it was kind of a no-brainer how quickly, you know, the message came together. Then I hooked up with Game Changer, and they were really open, really super receptive to the idea of the game. And I decided right in the very beginning that I was going to fully donate 100% of the proceeds. So 100%. Gross, not net. 100%. Not even after profit. So I'm not taking a penny of this game. I'm totally self-funding it and giving it directly to Game Changer, and which they're very excited about. And yeah, because I started the process, you know, with, you know, that way, that approach, a lot of other companies have jumped on board and have offered enormous amounts of support. And I think that was important right at the beginning to do that, because even if you give them 100% of profit, they still know that, like, you know, you can sort of, like, I don't know, be a little
fudge
bit
something.
Yeah, you can fudge something. You can be a little janky with the expenses and whatever. So I was like, you know what? I don't want anyone to have any misconception about, mm-hmm. you know, where we're coming from on this. So it's 100% of proceeds are going right to a Game Changer. So Microsoft immediately jumped on board. Xbox ID program immediately got behind us, has offered and has continued to offer an immense amount of support. In fact, Friday was my second trip up to Redmond to meet with the first party design team. I've been up there on multiple occasions to meet with the UR testing team, and they've brought it to Seattle Children's. They've brought it. They've brought in some patients and done a full usability review with those patients. Yeah, and it just goes on and on and on and on. And Xbox is going to be releasing this on their platform, and they as well are not going to take. They're not even going to take their cut, their normal percentage. And what's funny about that is that I was pretty sure that no one had really done anything like this before, but now I'm certain, because they actually told me that Xbox actually told me they don't technically have a way to not take their cut. Like, oh, wow. The system is hard coded,
yeah.
So they actually have to go back into the platform and like fix it to make it so that they can release this for free. Yeah, no, I know. It's crazy. But so, like, I'm definitely the first one.
It's like
that
one
this
of those
is,
edge cases. Yeah.
Right, exactly. Yeah. Well, I hope it's not an edge case in the future. I hope, you know, other developers step up and do more stuff like this. And I hope that this is not the first and last one for me. So it's overall, it's been huge. Razer. So my laptop fried last year, and Razer, totally stepped up to the plate and has been loaning me a Razer Blade, which is a screaming fast machine. Yes. And I've been doing my entire development all on the Razer Blade, which I absolutely love. It's a fantastic machine. They're great. Unity has donated pro licenses and assets. The support has been fantastic, and Game Changer as well, obviously, is doing everything that they can, bringing the social, the social good to the table. So it's just been an ultra positive experience, and I'm happy to be, you know, working with fantastic people. I've only met actually fantastic people in gaming so far. Maybe it's because I'm sort of like leading my, you know, I'm stepping into the room with this game like this, you know, like leading the way. Even still, it's been great so far meeting the people and working with those that I am.
Yeah, you've had like your hands pretty busy with this. Your game definitely stood out at GDC, and in fact, you came home with an award, right? And now, what was that?
I should grab that. It's right here. Hold on one second.
Oh, here we go.
Here it is.
Okay, and now, so for those who don't know, GDC has an annual award show, right? It's kind of like the Oscars, but for game development, on the second day of GDC. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
This is the award. the Gaming for Everyone Award. Yep. Basically recognizes developers that are working on games that have that serve or are being developed by a sort of an underrepresented community. Yeah. And children with cancer need games too. And yes. That's why I received that. And it says I hope right there at the top, and Arconics underneath. And I was very honored to receive this. This is a huge deal for me, because the amount of support that that Xbox specifically has been giving is already enough. And to kind of be singled out as doing something that they're really, you know, supportive and excited about is just icing on the cake. So this was really appreciated, and it's a huge honor.
Yeah, this is great. Yeah, you definitely came into gaming at the right time. The tools are more accessible than ever. The platforms are available to everybody at this point. Right. And your background wasn't always game development, right? That's still somewhat new to you, because you previously had a completely different background. And what was that?
Well, it's totally. Yeah, it's still super new. So I've been an animator almost 20 years. Actually, this is my 20th year as an animator. I only got into game dev. I you and I were talking at the show. I downloaded Unity and Unreal at the very end of 2014. I started the downloads at the same time. And I'm still only using Unity because the download finished first. That's it. it finished. I installed it. Unity was still going, or sorry, Unreal was still going. And then I got lost in Unity, and I never ever looked back. And it's funny. I tell that to the Unity guys. They love that story, of course, because I'm using their engine on the game. Yeah. But also, I say, listen, every once in a while, have your IT guys just run a quick test. Make mm-hmm. sure there's downloads faster. It matters. Look at this. Sometimes it's going to matter, you know, who downloads fastest. But animation is actually kind of a interesting way to get into game development, because animation is typically one of those parts of the game development process that is sort of obscure and difficult and a huge worry for game developers, in especially in the 3D space. Mm-hmm. We all saw, like, Mass Effect, you know, had a huge amount of backlash because some of the animation wasn't polished in their latest release.
I just picked it up the other day, and that was my concern. I waited for the patch. The patch okay. dropped and said, okay, now I can buy this.
Yeah, there you go. There you go.
It was just so jarring.
And like, you probably were thinking, like, people are, you know, audiences are getting pretty sophisticated, and there's just a baseline level that you need to achieve, otherwise your players are just going to think that, you know, it's not worth the money to get into. So, yeah. But having an animation background meant that I almost view animation as like, just like a side thought. Mm-hmm. Like, I'll think to myself, like, oh, what do I need in this level? I need to get the dialogue system hooked up. I need to order all the objectives and hook the objectives up to the inventory system. I need this. And what else? Oh, yeah, animation. And then, you know what I mean? So it's like, typically you'd be like, oh my God, I have like 16 characters. They all yeah. have like 25, you know, 25 different cycles and whatever. I'm just like, yeah, animation. Yeah. I think that gives me a huge advantage.
Especially when you consider some of the larger companies you've worked with, right? IBM, WWE, Warner Brothers, Universal, Sci-Fi, Nike, Fox, Saban,
yeah, they've been,
who just came Power Rangers. Yeah.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, as you go through this industry, I mean, the animation industry is super cutthroat. Arconics yeah. has been open for 11 years, and there's been obviously the ups and downs of the industry. But one steady thing has been that, like, our clients have always walked away happy. And, you know, I basically have that animation on lock. So using that as an advantage, I knew that kind of like the storytelling aspect and the message would be clearly delivered and in the game. And that's kind of how I'm, you know, I foresee the future. I don't think we're going to do many games that don't have a story to them. You know, we're not going to release, like, you know, the next shoot 'em up. There's really no meat there for us to sink our teeth into. But like yeah. a game like I Hope and like others in the future, I already have ideas for games that I want to work on after I Hope is released. Some of them deal with. Some of them deal with bullying. Some of them deal with, for instance, there's new legislation in the state of California where there needs to be mental health services provided to every single child in foster care. And there's something like 900,000 kids in foster care in California alone. It's a massive Yeah, it's a mass population, and getting the feedback that I am already from the you know, the patients and the parents, you know, that are dealing with cancer right now, in I hope and hearing and learning that it actually is already an emotional support for these kids. I think that I could very, very, very simply tune a message to start supporting like the kids in foster care, stuff like that. So I got long plans that that far into the future, and I think that having that animation background really means that I'm going to be focusing on things that like have a deep narrative and really try to reach out and touch people individually, you know, with the story.
No, definitely. And like the fact you've been doing it for nearly 20 years, it says a lot, because actually Freakonomics just had a podcast episode in February titled "No Hollywood Ending for the Visual Effects Industry."
Oh yeah, I saw that.
Right, and it was largely about how you were saying before, how cutthroat it is, but also how slim the margins are, how often studios will go in, you know, they'll undercut, you know, the competition to get a contract in hopes that this one will go smoothly, they'll then have more work afterwards, and it seldom works out that way because someone else will then undercut them on the next.
Right. And the big, larger studios take will actually take a project at a loss just because they can, it's better than nothing. I actually worked at some of the studios that have been mentioned, you know, in other articles in the past, like Ridley Hughes. You know, they were actually in the process of bankruptcy as they were accepting the Oscar for Life of Pi.
Yeah, right, which is crazy, right? And he's trying to get this out during his Oscar acceptance speech, and he just kind of cut short on time.
Yeah. Really, really, really sad. Yeah. So, I mean, that industry, it's night and day, to be honest. And again, I know that I'm getting a very soft landing in gaming because of the project that I chose to start with, but still it is night and day in gaming. You meet a lot more people that are serious about what they're doing and are more forthcoming with, you know, the capabilities that they have. And if they can help you and if they want to help you, you know, they normally follow through in gaming. Whereas in visual effects and animation and Hollywood in general, it's a lot more showmanship, a lot more smoke and mirrors. And I'm just kind of like on just like a personal level, like my soul, you know, is happier just working in games and being able to do what I'm doing. So and you mentioned this just now in this podcast about how it's like the perfect time to get in. I'm 34, so there's a lot of taking a huge chunk of the work out of, you know, out of my you know, foray into game development, that the engines are all free now. Right. So back when I would have had to choose game development as a career when I was in school, that would have meant that I'm not, you know, I don't even have a snowball's chance in hell if I don't know how to code like on like an assembly level and, you know, make my own engine and do all those things. So it really is, you know, in a lot of ways, you know, more than just what we've mentioned so far, it's a lot of ways, it's a fantastic time to get into game development. And I actually encourage anyone who's sort of like on the fence right now to download an engine. I recommend Unity.
Oh, absolutely.
And just start making stuff. It really, really is easier than you probably think.
Oh yeah, actually, book just arrived today. Foundations of Game Engine Development, and this is nothing but math the entire time. Vector math, talk about matrices, multiplication. And
hard
previously, guess. 10, 15 years ago, you had to do this to even start making a game. Today, the tools make it. I don't want to say easier. I want to say more accessible, right? Because if you have an animation background, you can get in. A math background, you can get in. Never done anything before, a lot of that's abstracted for you. So you definitely came in at the right time. The industry, you know, finally recognizes a lot of the talent. You know, they have award shows, like, you know, what you received earlier. And at the same time, it's still a very, very small industry. Still somewhat in its infancy, right? Film, you know, it's been around for nearly 100 years at this point, if not more.
Yeah, over 100 years.
I always think of like Lawrence of Arabia, right? That's like the first like film that kind of comes to mind for me. You know, it's black and white. They finally, you know, colored every cell by hand to even get that colored effect. And that was 100 years ago. Today in games, again, still very, very new. So it's learning, it's adopting, it's growing. But yeah, what you're doing, combining, you know, charities and gaming, you're doing quite a bit, and again, like, just the perfect time.
Well, I hope it's the beginning of, not just for me, I hope it's the beginning for the industry. And I agree it's in its infancy. It's kind of like the Wild West. Like everyone's kind of, especially when you have like new technologies emerging so quickly, like one after another, you know, like a freely accessible 3D engine. That was huge. You know, that was a big thing that like started happening you know, 5 or 6 years ago. It started becoming, you know, like a cheaper free. And now we have VR and AR and like as those things are really popping out quickly. Whereas in film, you had like 35 millimeter film. And then for the next 85 years, you had 35 millimeter film. You know what I mean?
Yeah, you had
better lensing and you had, you know, had sound. Then you started having, you know, digital projection. And then you started, and then digital cameras started being better, green screen, visual effects. So, like, there's been like a leap in the past, like 25 years, I would say, for film. But yeah, in games, though, ever since they started, we've had almost this like really fast cascading, like rapid evolution, and we're still in the infancy. And it's a great time to it's a great time to get in. And I hope that more people figure out a way in that makes them happy.
Yeah. So before kind of diverging to something else, I've got to ask a question specifically about, you know, animation and visual effects and things like that. So I love film. Particular monster movies or pop culture of the 80s, right? So sure. I look at like Stan Winston and all the work they're doing. The Fly, The Thing, Aliens. Do you ever think that there'll be either a resurgence, something similar, practical effects, I should say. Will there be a resurgence of practical effects in the film industry?
I heard that, yeah, I actually heard that the next Jurassic World is going to rely much more heavily on puppeteering and practical effects.
Because so much of that holds up so well. Right, even the original Jurassic Park, spring of 1993, it came out, and most of it was practical effects. They did do a handful of digital effects. It was a bit different than we have today, right? Today we use typically like polygons that you're creating the whole time. Back then, you used something called NURBS, and which is still used. Yeah, I just did some 3D modeling for a little while, but never really got too far with it. And even having watched Jurassic Park again a few months ago, I watched it and just thought like, geez, this holds up so well for a 24-year-old movie.
Yeah, in the VFX industry, we still like we don't quite actually know why the Jurassic Park, specifically like the T-Rex out of the enclosure, like in the rain. Specifically that scene, we all kind of like are like we just kind of like shrug our shoulders and like, yep, it holds up.
Yeah,
and it's weird because they had nothing. They really had nothing. There's something called forward kinematics and inverse kinematics. Essentially, forward kinematics is great for things like Tails, where you have the base moving the end. Inverse kinematics is good for when you want to actually make the end drive the parent. So it's good for
like the physics behind animation.
Exactly. So if you don't know what those are, all you need to know is that it is almost impossible to animate like a walk cycle without inverse kinematics. And they didn't have inverse kinematics when they made Jurassic Park. So they had to go in almost like a puppeteer and make the legs when they're hitting the ground. They had to do that frame by frame and make it not jitter and not wiggle and whatever. And it still holds up, even the animation, not just the render and what it looks like, but the animation holds up. We're just astounded at the industry. Why that one is, it's like the first one and it still looks some of the best.
Yeah, and the tools were so primitive back then too, right? Plus, you know, they don't have the render farms that we have today. You couldn't even rent a render farm from somewhere if you wanted to, right? It's like you own that entire thing and that's yours.
I was actually up at ILM around the time of Jurassic
Park. ILM, for those who don't know, is
Industrial Light and Magic. They are the studio that works on all the Jurassic Parks. They do Transformers, Star Wars. It's George Lucas's visual effects company. Anyway, so I was up at ILM around the time of Jurassic Park 3, and I heard that they didn't even have inverse kinematics until Jumanji. we're talking about
that came out 1995.
That was later. That was like almost.
No, I'll tell you, because I saw my third grade birthday party.
I think it was like 98 maybe. Either way, they
95.
They,
there we go.
They had dozens of movies that 95. They had dozens of movies though that they didn't have these tools that like we consider essential today. And talking about computing power, like the iPhone in your pocket is more powerful than the entire computing setup that they had to make the original Toy Story.
Yeah, And even Toy Story, right? Again, 1995. Pixar had worked on that for, you know, years leading up to it.
Right.
And now they actually have like a moving museum. I say moving, like it goes from place to place. They just had it here in Philadelphia about 6 months ago, where Pixar had like set up a large explanation of like how they had built all of these frames, how they did the rendering. Cool way to get kids involved. But even as a grown adult, you know, I'd watched that in my childhood, and I'm still enamored by it. And you've got to wonder, how many people does it inspire to want to become animators and artists in the future?
Well, that's a good. That's a good kind of way to segue into. John Lasseter likes to say that like art inspires the technology, the technology drives the art, and so yes. it's like that circle. Well, and to go off what you're saying, you know, how much of the technology right now is actually inspiring, you know, artists to start creating, not just in animation, games as well. If you can imagine, let's roll back 200 years when like the most, you know, the highest level of visual visual expression was probably still like oil paint, right? So you are a kid that lives out in a rural area. You make it to the big city. It's like 1758. And you happen to wander into a museum. I'm not sure how. Who cares? And you see like Monet, and then like your life is changed, right?
Yeah.
We kind of overlook that because like technology has gotten sort of like it runs so parallel to our lives that mm-hmm. I think we've actually trained ourselves to just be able to just like factor in new technology and just like keep on living. But for some people, I think that the technology that we are still coming out with today is going to be the deciding factor of whether we get like our next Monet in gaming, our next, you know, Picasso in gaming. You know, certain things like facial animation capture that they do, you know, on some games gets the, I mean, I just finished Uncharted 4 and oh my lord.
Beautiful.
And the stories. So like, you know, I'm married, I got two kids and, I don't want to say like hit close to home, but like the husband and wife story in Uncharted 4, where like he's like, you know, do I bring her into this? Because she'll be really upset about this, but I also have to help my brother. Like that whole thing, it was such a fantastic approach, and I don't think that they could have achieved that if they didn't have the technology to really pull off the subtle facial animation and the renders. You get totally pulled out of it. If it's just like two polygons, you know, like sort of like flapping at each other, you're kind of like, I'm not really into it. But man, when she gave him like the look, and all the married guys out, you know the look, okay? Yep. So when she gives him the look, you're like, oh man, I don't know what I'm supposed to do right now. This poor guy.
Even like the sentimental moments, like where they're sitting down playing Crash Bandicoot, was very similar to, there's a game called The Darkness that came out 2007-ish. And there's a scene towards the beginning where the main character, Jackie, the protagonist, and he's with his girlfriend sitting on the couch kind of watching TV. And you can kind of just sit there and listen to their dialogue or make, you know, subtle choices. And I remember that really stood out to me too, because you're like really engrossed in what's happening there, largely because of the way the camera's set up, the TV's on, the light is like subtly coming onto their face and reflecting off of their skin, right? Which is another animation tactic, or I should say a visual effects tool. But all that goes so far, and specifically with Uncharted, that animation team knocked out of the park, the writing team knocked out of the park, and it shows you the value in really going platform exclusive sometimes, because they eked out like every bit of power from that PlayStation to make it look as beautiful as it did.
Oh yeah, man. And you know, finally on top of it all, they have a respect from their players that the franchise is being, you know, shepherded. And so I think they feel like they can take some gameplay and storytelling chances because they've respected their fan base, and they know like, hey, let's try to go like maybe a little bit further with this choice or this idea, or like maybe kind of actually the other direction, where it's like, you know, maybe in a game you wouldn't really want there to be such a front and center, you know, plot about like marriage, you know, Like, do people really want to sit around and like, you know, see this game that has like this big marriage like sub-story to it? But like, I think that they've done so well, and they respect and they know what a fan base is.
Yep.
that they went there, and I like seeing games that kind of have those aspects to them.
Yeah. No, I think knocked out of the park with that. Yeah, I had to ask about, you know, the visual effects, and especially with your background. And just even yesterday, I watched BFG, Big Friendly yeah. Giant, yeah. Steven Spielberg film from last year. It's very hard to watch BFG and not think of the gun from Doom.
As a gamer, yeah.
I'd explain this to a little guy later on, like what that yeah. was. But the facial animations in that film were fantastic too. The giants, the ogres, whatever they are, there's, you know, as a whole, the industry is still learning how to make skin and things look realistic, but the facial animations were beautiful and akin to what we'd seen with L.A. Noire maybe in 2011 or so. Had you ever had a chance to play that?
I did. I played that, and my wife and I actually played it with my wife because she's not a big gamer at all. Mm-hmm. She likes puzzle games and that kind of stuff, but yeah, that was one that where we actually – you know, could kind of get into, because some of the time I was like, no, nah, he's totally lying. And she was like, no, it's fine. Right. No, come on, today. I'm like, no, I don't think so. Yeah. And so she was right sometimes. So it was really funny to see that. Some of the faces, I'm sure, because the technology is consistent throughout the game. So it was obviously the actors. Some of the times when they were lying, they were like, and I was like,
come on, buddy.
Yeah, you're hamming it up.
Yeah. They had a making of with that game too, where they illustrated how they did that. Essentially, they'd have the actors sit in a chair and have in a large warehouse. They had about 32 cameras around them, and they would capture frames from every camera, line it all up, and this way they could line up their facial gestures perfectly. And to your right. point earlier about studios going out of business, Team Bondi, who is part of who makes the GTA franchise? I don't know why I'm drawing a blank. Rockstar. They're like a subsidiary of Rockstar in Australia. They shut down before the game even launched. Basically, the game went gold. Go into the presses and they said, yeah, that's it. We're shut down. Because it took them so long to get it out the door. So the game had finished, was going to be printed, and they said, that's it. Nothing's coming out.
Yeah, it's hard. I mean, in almost every industry, there's the people that are driving the technology, and they have to have continued success or they stop. So like Pixar, everyone's like, wow, like how do you release like 20 films that are all like Oscar winners or, you know, 99% fresh? You know what I mean? Yeah. How do you do that? And well, they have their formula, but they are driving the technology. They are driving in animation, at least. They are driving sort of like the rendering and the animation technology. And thank God for them, because, you know, we all get to benefit from that. But yeah, in certain industries, that's what ends up happening, is you get the people that are really trying to do something new with the technology, and if they just hit a snag, or it just takes too long for them to get it exactly right, then they don't end up doing well. I would say that we kind of saw a similar thing with No Man's Sky, yes. which I like to call Nemansky. with Nemansky, I have a different take on that entire thing. I don't think Nemansky didn't do well because they didn't promise or they didn't deliver on some of the promises that they had made while they were working on it. I actually think that the entire premise of a game where you are constantly reminded about your real life temporal existence is just not a great idea. In other words, they said like there's like whatever 45 quintillion different planets. It would take you like 88 million lifetimes to see them all. Well, it'll take me 88 million lifetimes to see, you know, half the planets in our galaxy. So like, why would I want to spend a futile amount of time in a game where like I live as long as a human does. Yeah. So, but at any rate, but yeah, I mean, they got really hammered because I think that they focus a lot on sort of the procedural generated nature of it and trying to make it so that it was a seamless experience going from planet to planet and less on all these things that they were they were promising, which you can't, like a lot of the things, and I've looked over the list of, you know, the of the things that people were the most upset about that were in the game, all those things, I mean, like, especially like the multiplayer functionality that they said that it was going to be there that wasn't, all those things, you can't graft that onto like a finished procedurally generated space exploration game. That's just not how development works.
So
you know, they drove a lot of technology and sort of like new gameplay ideas there. But again, yeah, they kind of got hammered on the final product because of the you know, the delivery of that. So we rely in every industry. I mean, I'm sort of like, you know, I have like 1 foot in animation still and 1 foot in gaming, and in every industry we're constantly looking at like who's doing what and how are, you know, how much success are they having, especially taking advantage of new technologies. And as soon as somebody, you know, has even a little marginal success using something, everyone else jumps on, and it's interesting to see. Or it will be interesting to see, like, as things go on, VR and AR. No one really has had the doom or the, I guess you should say, Wolfenstein of VR yet. There have been some successful games that are released also in VR, like Alien Isolation was probably one of the bigger titles that I think did well, and people it was well received because of its VR, its appropriateness for VR, because you can't fight, all you can do is sneak around, and that kind of feels like something that you should do in VR. I feel you have to pay such a huge sensory price, even with the controllers, you have to pay too large a sensory price for most VR experiences. We still haven't had our Wolfenstein of VR, and it's going to be very interesting to see who figures out what that is.
Yeah, even the cost of entry is a big barrier for a lot of people too. Plus, you know, hedging bets. I mean, you know, even if I wanted an entry level VR system, right? The cheapest I could do was I could get perhaps a PlayStation VR, but then I'd need a $300 PlayStation, $300 or $400 VR kit. So $600 or $700 right there. Yeah. But then if I'm doing that, that means I'm missing out on Oculus or HTC Vive or HoloLens. Like, you know, there's all these different paths, and we don't know who the clear winner is. Although I will tell you, I've seen some good VR content. Most of it, I want to say, is around, I don't want to say gimmicky, that because that's the wrong word. I want to say like brief experiences. And typically this has been around events like Comic-Con. So I go to Comic-Con New York every year. And had some great experiences there, particularly around shows. So, for example, Westworld had a fantastic like VR experience, as did Man in the High Castle. So they're like, they're very, very short-lived experiences, you know, when you're kind of like guided through a tour. But because you have the headset on, the VR goggles, you're not really interacting with things so much as you're kind of just in that moment, in that scene, and everything's unfolding around you.
See, that's the thing. So I talk with a lot of content creators. I actually know creators of a couple of like hit shows on the networks, and they see VR as, because they don't come from this world, they see VR as something that can supplement, like an on-rails experience that can give you, you know, like additional to the story and whatever. It's going to be, I don't think I'm going to be the person to do it, but it is going to be someone who actually approaches it with like a direct approach. Like this is something different than storytelling in, you know, like a linear, you know, flat narrative sense. And we'll just have to see. One of the most fun games that I think that I've seen, I don't know the name of it, but it was sort of like Keep Talking and Nobody Explodes.
But
it was a VR version where two people with VR, and only one person can see into the bomb, and the other person can read the manual.
That was that game.
They
actually started with just VR first, and then so it'd be appealing to more people, they took out the VR experience as well.
Actually glad that it was, because, well, there you go. Isn't that interesting? So just on its basest sense, well, you can cheat and play Keep Talking No One Explodes by yourself, and you can have the manual up, and you can kind of do that thing. And I've seen YouTube videos of people doing that, but that was way more a direct approach to why VR is a new medium, because, like, I mean, on its basis level, I mean, you have Like, we're humans, we have one point of view. And, like, why not take advantage of the fact that one person could be able to see something that somebody else couldn't? You know, that might be too simplistic, but somebody who comes up with, like that very base level idea and is able to attach a narrative to that is going to make the big VR hit that actually brings everybody on board, I think.
Yeah. So no VR for you in the near future.
Not for me.
Creating experiences, I should say.
Yeah, I don't know. I never say never. I actually have been looking into this audio video therapy for people suffering from PTSD.
Okay.
And they're having a lot of success with VR, and I've been trying to think up of like what I could add on top of it to make it even better. But for the time being, I mean, unless that's the next game that I work on, you know, from the philanthropic standpoint, probably not in the near future.
Okay. Well, so now we're kind of starting to come towards an end. What can you say is in the future for you, for the studio, and what advice would you have for anyone else who wants to get started in games, but particularly around working with charitable causes like what you've done?
It's very easy to get in touch with the charities. It's super, super, super easy. If you have an idea for a game and you're willing to, you know, give it away, a charity is a great place to start because they do have a network typically already of supporters and donors and people that want to help the charity, and they will see what you're doing as a great way to help them in the future. So I would say a charitable game, a philanthropic game, great way to break into the game industry in terms of making a big splash with limited resources. If you aren't in game development already, just jump in. If you're, if you haven't even started, the best day to start doing anything worthwhile is 10 years ago. The second best day is today.
That's right.
So just do it. Just do it. Just don't wait and do it. For the most part, my future is wide open with I hope. I know that the impact is going to be large. We have a lot of big companies and really, really supportive people that are behind the game, pushing it into all areas and trying to do a lot for it. So I'm pretty confident that's going to be a big gaming story, and people who are, you know, even outside of the gaming industry are going to hear about I hope. Through the marketing channels that are being put behind it. So we'll see what comes of that. My goal is that I'm going to be approached to make the next one.
Yeah.
So that, you know, maybe some sort of foundation or organization is going to come forward and say, hey, we love what you did with I Hope. We have this problem that we want to try to solve with gaming. Would you be interested? And it would be great to actually, you know, get some funding to make that game. I'm totally happy to have had funded I Hope on my own, but it would be great to get a funded project that I can really focus and work on. But yeah, my future is wide open. But regardless of what it is, I know it's going to be really fun and fantastic.
All right. So the way I like to close out every show is I take a question from the previous week. That is, I've asked whoever joined me for the last episode to come up with a question for the next guest.
And oh, cool.
That'd be you. But it has to be something gaming or game development related. And then afterwards, okay, I'd like for you to do the same. That is, come up with a question for my next guest. So the question from last week was from Sean Woods, a Canadian game developer that's working on a fantastic mobile game. He asked, what was your favorite project that you've worked on throughout your career and why?
That's funny because I have a long career in animation, and I learned so much from that helped me get into games. And so to answer that, I would have to say that probably my short film that I made in 2013 called The Little Painter was my favorite. That kind of gave me the boost that I needed right at that time in terms of do I have storytelling ability and do I have the do I have the narrative straight and is this entertaining to audiences and whatever. So it was a big confidence booster, having worked in the industry for a long time doing service work and working for big companies and small companies where you're kind of a cog in a wheel. That actually leads me to another recommendation. Even if you're not in, even if you're not in game development, if you're in any creative field, I would say definitely if you can take the time that you need to do a personal project every once in a while, you need that side thing kind of like feeding your creativity and reinstilling that desire to create in you. Otherwise, you'll burn out eventually if you're just working for other people and getting no no real creative input and positive feedback and that kind of thing. So I've been I've been really lucky. It was Kickstarter funded, and I had a lot of people help me on the film, and it turned out great. I mean, you can check it out, thelittlepaintermovie.com.
Yeah, we're at Kickstarter right now.
Oh, cool. Yeah, so that was really, really, really fantastic. So I would say that that was pivotal in making me be able to jump into gaming and have a lot of fun. And I hope really sort of has the same tone and sweetness as The Little Painter. And it was fun. That was a great question.
And now, so do you have a question of similar greatness for the next guest?
Oh, geez, no pressure. I would ask if. When you've been gaming, what was the biggest aha moment you had when you were in a game as to what a choice that they had made when they were making the game would affect the player? It can be anything from the placement of a camera or the specific type of animation on the player or whatever. But what is the biggest thing that made you have like a aha moment as to why that choice was made?
Okay, so it could be about learning or about the experience as a whole.
Right.
Nice. Yeah, that is a good one, because I'm not going to talk about answering your question. I'll save it for next week. But I just had an email the other day with some programmer friends. We go back and forth every day, a handful of us, and I brought up an aha moment that I had when reading a book. So I'm doing a lot of math, which I absolutely hate, but. I have to look at 20 different tutorials before I finally catch on to something, right? Even trying to visualize like logarithmic graphing. And then all of a sudden I read one line that someone wrote and I said, "Ah, now this makes sense to me. Okay, perfect. I get this whole thing finally came together because of that one line."
Those are great, aren't they though?
Yeah, yeah. And you're thinking like, why didn't someone explain this previously like that? But I guess everyone's mind works, uniquely. So yeah, that's a good question to have as well. All right, I got a lot of good notes for this podcast. This is great. Before we get out of here, do you have any other things that you'd like to highlight? Any blogs, URLs, social media?
Yeah, we develop. Yeah, so I hope is almost essentially entirely developed live on twitch.tv. If you go to twitch.tv/Arconyx, A-R-C-O-N-Y-X, you can check out and hit the follow button. And all of the subscriptions, we're partnered on Twitch, so all of the subscriptions directly help the development of iHope. So you're actually doing something good with your subscription. If you're an Amazon Prime member, you get a free subscription on a Twitch channel every single month. You just hit the subscribe button and then use the free Twitch Prime subscription on the top right. Very easy to do. So, I mean, that's really the only place to go to see more on the game and see more of what I'm doing. And I love it when people come through and ask questions. So just come on by and say hi.
It looks like you're very active on here. Already have 87 videos archived. So you're pretty consistent with the amount of work you're putting on there.
We're trying to be.
Yeah. And even like right now, someone else is being hosted with a hard difficulty. So more programming you can see going on there.
Yeah.
Cool. Yeah, I love it when I see people able to either do tutorials or programming on Twitch. There's quite a bit that I follow from, I'm drawing a blank. Guy worked on, why can I not remember this?
Talking about the ZBrush guy?
No. It's all programming. He wrote his own engine in C and C++.
You're talking about Handmade Hero.
Handmade Hero. That's it. Handmade Hero. So before we get out of here, I've got to show people that. If you ever want to learn low-level programming, this is fantastic. Handmade Hero. Every day he goes on, answers questions, live streams what he does. Open sources the code for if you pay that $20 or whatever for it. Basically, if you're looking to get into the games industry to learn, this is another fantastic way too. We're at a really good time right now where people can learn easily, share what they're doing again for Twitch and things of that nature. So you've done a great job with it.
Yeah.
I'd love to have you back on the next time you're working on a project or anything else you'd like to highlight or get people involved. So
you got it. We're releasing I Hope at PAX West, so I'm sure we'll talk again before then, and we'll do more. Thanks for having me on.
Perfect. Thanks again.